Morning, everyone. We're going to get started with the February 6, 2017 meeting of the Economic Development and Trade Committee. And we thank you for being here as we continue to shape the mission and the work of this new committee. So hopefully it really helps us create jobs and opportunity all throughout Oregon. Today, as part of our orientation for the role that economic development and trade play in our economy and the potential levers that state government has to try to help support those things at a legislative level, we are going to have a few different informational sessions. And we're going to begin with an information session by two of my favorite new colleagues who spoke with us many times in the House Revenue Committee to describe the shape and features of the Oregon economy at revenue forecast time. And they're going to talk to us about Oregon's economy, its overall size, what's changing, kind of how it functions by region, output, trade agreements. It's really fascinating stuff. And with that, I'd like to open an informational meeting that will stay open for the rest of the session and invite up Mark McMullen, the state economist with the Office of Economic Analysis, and Josh Lehner, the senior economist also in that office. Welcome, gentlemen. Thanks for being here at 8 a.m.
Oh, thanks for having us. For the record, my name is Mark McMullen, the state economist. I'm joined by my colleague, Josh Lehner. As Chair Leininger mentioned, we have put together a brief high-level overview of the Oregon economy with a little bit of a focus on trade. And hopefully this will help you guys get started. I know how much legislators love informational sessions, so we'll try to go fast. And if you want any follow-ups or any more detail on this stuff, please don't hesitate to reach out to us.
Madam Chair, I like him already.
So just to start, a little update on recent performance, where the Oregon economy is in the business cycle, how we're doing in terms of our recovery and our performance relative to other states, which, as usual, is a pretty good story. For Oregon, when the U.S. economy is growing, we're growing faster. This has happened in every expansion since World War II. We've outperformed the U.S., at least in terms of job growth, which is what you see here, the dark line being Oregon's job growth relative to the lighter blue line being the national average. And so this isn't surprising. The problem in Oregon isn't how well we do during the expansions. It's how poorly we do during the recessions. Just as we outperform during the expansions, we tend to outperform pretty drastically when we have downturns as well. But where we are right now in the business cycle is a little different than the experience that we're seeing in other states. We've been really growing at full throttle for a couple of years. It's every bit as fast as we did during the housing boom, which hasn't really been the case in most places or in a lot of states, where there's still room to improve, and a lot of national forecasters are still seeing the U.S. Economy or are expecting it to accelerate some going forward, and we've seen some good job numbers at the U.S. level. That's not the case in Oregon, because unlike the rest of the U.S., we've been doing well for some time, and as a result have taken a lot of the slack out of our job market. And so our expansion is kind of getting into a more mature phase, where we're no longer digging out of the recessionary hole and growing at these boom levels, but rather starting to transition into something that's a little more long-term, sustainable over the long term. But it does appear that for now, though, quite a bit of the slack has been taken out of the Oregon labor market, and that leads us to believe that things are going to change going forward. And on the good side, we're starting to see the improvements in the economy become much more broad-based, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, insofar as we're starting to see these job gains translate into wage gains, into people coming back into the labor force, which is just beginning to happen in other states, but we're seeing really happen in a large way here, and we're starting to see gains spread out both across regions of the state, where our rural areas are growing as fast as they ever do right now, and also in terms of income levels, and we're seeing growth now with low-income households, and as well as those on the top end. And so this is encouraging, because these are some of the things that are the last to turn around in an economic recovery sometimes. In particular, the measures that are always the last to turn around, the stickiest, are things like the poverty rates and the caseloads for our need-based income maintenance and health care programs. And those we're finally starting to see some improvement now that we have a tighter labor market. And I'm going to pass to Josh to talk a little bit about where we are in terms of the labor market.
Thanks, Mark. For the record, Josh Landis, economist, the Office of Economic Analysis. And that's right. This chart here is just trying to get some sort of gauge of how many people are looking for work versus how many job openings there are in the state. And you can see we're down roughly ratio of 2-1, which is about as tight as we've been at any point in recent history. It's basically two people saying, hey, I want a job, versus how many businesses are saying, hey, we have a job. And we know we've had some participation issues, right? The Great Recession was so bad, so severe, people looked for work for a couple of years and they gave up looking just because they were discouraged given the really terrible state of the economy. Even if you add all of those folks back in that probably should be in the labor force during a healthy economic expansion, but they're not today, but if you add all those people back in, you get the dark blue line, which is a 3-1 ratio, right? So we've made a lot of progress on getting some of these people that were discouraged come back into the economy. And this is really good news. We're not fully healthy along those lines, but we've seen a lot of progress being made. And so here again, we're getting to this tight labor market where we're expecting growth to slow down, but for a good reason. However, as Mark was saying, it's translating into finally some progress being made on our deeper measures of recovery, or those stickier measures. And I think one of those ones in particular, we're talking household income for those in the middle and bottom part of the income distribution. Here, we've looked at inflation-adjusted household income for those at the top 20%, those in the middle 20%, kind of the median household, and those at the bottom 20% of Oregon households. And you can see that the higher-income households have outperformed in recent years and obviously in recent decades. Part of this has to do with the nature of their income. Not only do a lot of these have high-wage jobs associated with these higher-income households, but they also have capital gains, dividends, interest income and the like, some of those other types of income that have outperformed certainly in the last 10, 20, 30 years. For the middle and bottom part of the income distribution, those that suffered the largest losses during the recession, all they have are wages, right? All they have is the job market. And so they really rely on a tight labor market, a full employment economy to drive any sort of meaningful income gains. And we're starting to see that in recent years. You can see here the median household in Oregon and those in the lower parts of the income distribution aren't all the way back to where they were 10 years ago, but the progress being made in the last 2 or 3 years is actually pretty sizable, and we're starting to see these turn around considerably. So this is good news. We expect these sort of patterns to continue over the next couple of years as the labor market remains tight.
Yeah, of course, unfortunately, for the bottom households in terms of income level, they haven't recovered fully, largely just because they took such a big hit, as is usually the case in recessions, that our lower income households take it on the nose or the chin. We're also seeing the recovery start to become more broad-based across regions. Here we're looking at the share of Oregon's counties that are adding jobs right now. And as you see here, it's all but one at this point, which is about as good as it ever gets. The one county we have right now that is not adding jobs is actually one of our success stories over the cycle, would be Morrow. They had some of the construction projects in the Port of Morrow and Boardman have been winding down. So you're seeing some small job losses there. But nevertheless, if you stand back and look at the cycle as a whole, this was an area that was growing long before the rest of the state and is doing much better in terms of where it stands today versus pre-recession or even in the immediate aftermath of the recession. So that it's almost impossible to really, or maybe not impossible, but very unlikely to get all of our counties adding jobs. But right now, it was certainly every broad region of the state is experiencing expanding, and that's encouraging. And so if we look even outside of our metropolitan areas, if we take those out, rural Oregon right now is growing as fast as the U.S. average, which is just about as good as it gets. Here we've broken that down into some more detail. I apologize that the bubble chart on the right is based on data through September rather than the more recent December data, which you see in the bar chart on the left. But this is just a way to take a look at individual counties and individual regions and see how far they have come back. Both two different charts basically explaining the same thing. In terms of the regions on the left, you see here the length of the bar, when you look to the left where those dark bars are, that's how far these regions fell in terms of their job base during the recession. So in Oregon as a whole lost on average about 8% of its jobs. But now, as you go to the right, this is where we stand today. So while Oregon lost 8% of its jobs during the recession, they've gained those back and plus added another 6.5 since then. So as you see, we've seen a lot of improvement. Even in particular, what stands out would be Central Oregon, that took such a massive recession, lost twice as many jobs as the rest of the state, but has just been booming ever since. But all regions have added some jobs, although the southern south coast and southeast Oregon have yet to return to their pre-recession peak. And even for those who have, places like Southern Oregon and Northeast Oregon that are just about where they were before the recession, one comment you need to make is that this doesn't account for population gains. So some of these places are bigger now than they were then, and so they wouldn't be considered fully healed. But nevertheless, we are seeing growth across the state, and what our struggling counties that are left over, you see there, Gilliam, Grant, Crook, Klamath, and the like, don't make up a very large part of the overall broader state economy now. So,
interrupt you for a second.
Yeah, sorry.
This is such an interesting presentation. We've got at least one question right now, Rep. Clem.
I'm just apparently not good with maps here or charts. So the very bottom one, South Coast, the one I'm interested in. So What does that mean exactly, that there was a 13-ish percent reduction and six of it came after the recession officially ended?
That's correct. More so, I'm sorry, Chair Leininger, Representative Clem. Yes, the way to read this, and I'm sorry, I really should have taken more time. I'm just trying to speed through these to let you know what you're looking at. So for South Coast, it would say, as you said, it looks like about a 13% decline in jobs during the recession. But since then, they've recovered about half of them back. So now they stand 6% below where they were headed into the recession.
Oh, okay.
So still 6% fewer jobs than they had at the peak just before things went south. So just about half of them back now, or a little bit more than half.
Thank you.
And so that's how you read the bubble chart is, well, what share have we have back? And most counties, at least all of our big counties, are at least 100, have gained them all back. But we do see some stragglers in terms of our coastal counties and some of our eastern Oregon counties that are halfway back or less. But for the typical or average rural county now, we're looking at about three-quarters of the way back.
And one more, Representative Post.
I understand the bar graph.
Yeah.
I don't...
must be you.
The definition of... Thank you, Madam Chair. the definition of Lambert Valley, would that be like, what, Wilsonville to Roseburg? Or what is under this chart?
Chair Leininger, Representative Post. Unfortunately, there are no set geographic definitions uniform across state agencies. In our office's definition, which we try and adhere to the Employment Department as best we can, the Willamette Valley is five counties. So Polk, Marion, Lynn, Benton, Lane. So it's south of Portland down to Eugene, and not to Roseburg. Roseburg's southern or south. Southern, yeah. So Douglas County is southern in this chart.
And Yamhill is in the Portland metropolitan area.
Oh, so Yam, really?
Correct. That's correct. Yamhill is part of the official U.S. government's Portland Metropolitan Statistical Area because of the commuter flows. Not that their local economy is organized such as a metropolitan area. It's more Willamette Valley, obviously, with the ag influence. But yeah. Given the commuter flows, they are officially part of the Portland region.
So we have another question from Representative Brocksmith, and then I'm going to ask folks to hold their questions if they can, because we actually only have 15 minutes allocated for you good people, but we will probably want to invite you back sometime soon. And I'm going to ask Rep. Brocksmith to go and then ask you to move quickly through the rest, but I would hate to have you not get to finish.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Good morning. South Coast, same question. Those counties would be Coos, Curry. Do you go inland to Douglas, Josephine as well, or?
No, for this purposes, no, South Coast is just Coos and Curry. Southern is Douglas, Josephine, Jackson. For the record.
Thank you. Great.
Okay, so we're going to skip ahead a little bit. Just to summarize, you know, so why, so we can get to the trade issues that we were asked to address. But so we saw this in the first chart that, well, Oregon always grows faster during expansions, typically falls a lot farther during recession. So why is that? There are really two reasons. One is we're still a place that makes things, although we're not immune to the globalization and technological change that you're seeing elsewhere in terms of the size of the manufacturing pie in the U.S. has been shrinking over time here as well, but we've been taking an increasingly larger share of that pie over time, given our comparative advantages. And with exposure to resource industries and goods-producing industries like manufacturing, this exposes us to a lot of volatility. And so far as these industries tend to have big boom-bust cycles themselves and tend to be really coordinated in time with the national business cycle. And so that's one big reason, although the...
I don't want to have you skip over your slides just because I think it's such a rich, interesting presentation. So you know, please go through them and just with an eye to, we won't ask you questions. And if you can be as efficient as you can, that'd be great.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Leininger. I apologize for producing too much information. So, yeah, with this slide, it's just the trying to put a picture of what I just said insofar as the blue line is the share of Oregon's jobs accounted for by manufacturers. So it was a third of our jobs coming out of World War II. We're looking at 10% of our jobs today. So this is, we are not immune to what's going on in the global economy. However, the red line suggests that we're doing a much better job than other states. We've seen our share of U.S. manufacturing go up by 50% over this same time, and basically in good times and bad. We haven't really seen our share has stepped down a little bit in two times you see here in the 1980s when all the timber mills closed and were modernized here, and then again here for a brief time after the housing boom, and again that can be really pointed to the wood products manufacturing. But wood products manufacturing, although still extremely important for the state, fortunately it's not all we lean on, and a lot of other states, the reason we've grabbed so much of the manufacturing share over time is that we've been able to get to a more modern mix of manufacturing. While a lot of the states in the Rust Belt, the auto manufacturers, or the textile mills in the South, or some of the farm manufacturing in the Grain Belt have not. And a lot of that has to do with the emergence of our high-tech sector, which is every bit as big now as the forest product sector was in the 1970s. The main difference being the geographic footprint, where these firms and where these jobs are located across the state. One thing to when you're working on economic development, one thing to keep in mind is that although manufacturing is certainly and traded sector is certainly our comparative advantage, this is where we need to focus. Times have changed, and in particular, manufacturing jobs and in all of our industries, tech included, are not quite what they used to be. And also not as much income, and the benefits of these jobs are kept within the local economy as they used to be. A lot of them are shipped to other states and overseas now as well in terms of some of the profits. Here we're looking at wages in manufacturing relative to the statewide average wage, where manufacturing workers got 25 or a third or a quarter more wages than the typical worker back in the 70s. But over time, that wage advantage is eroded to where now most manufacturing jobs in Oregon just make roughly the same or just a little bit more than the typical job. You see here there is an exception that all manufacturing computer and electronics workers are making higher wages, but even that isn't a purely positive story insofar as those high wages are disproportionately reflect engineers and research and development positions, whereas the typical manufacturing worker, the assembly job or the person in the bunny suit that you might think of, has seen the same sort of trends that we've seen in the forest sector and in other manufacturers, where the line workers are making no more than a typical worker would. But in addition, in terms of this boom-bust cycle, while the manufacturing and the exposure to goods is very important, it's not quite as important as reason number two, which has to do with our positive migration trends.
Sorry, population growth is probably the most important reason for the boom-bust nature of the Oregon economy. People move to Oregon in good times and bad. And here you just see a historical look at migration flows and population growth here into the state. The dark part of the bars are migration, people physically relocating to Oregon. The light portion is natural increase. That's births minus deaths, so it takes into account some of those changing birth rates and death rates. And so this is probably a large reason, and it's boom-bust because during a recession, people hunker down and they don't want to move because if I can't get a job anywhere, you know, why would I stick my neck out and move necessarily where there are no jobs there in the second location either? However, in good times when jobs are available, we certainly see a large influx of new residents to the state of Oregon, and the types of residents we see matter quite a lot for long-term economic growth. And on the next chart, we'll see that the bulk of these migrants are in what we call the root-setting years, your 20s and your 30s, which is when most people start their careers in earnest. They begin to settle down, get married, have kids, buy a house, all these sort of good things. And sure, the millennials are doing that a couple years later than previous generations, but it's still happening. Maybe it's in their early 30s instead of their mid to late 20s as generations passed. And a lot of these root-setting years, folks are really good for long-run growth because once they move, they usually don't move again. And so you have this young supply of skilled working-age population for the rest of their life, basically, which is good news for the Oregon economy. The other bump you tend to see in terms of migration would be the retirees, those in their later career years looking to maybe cut hours, retire, things like that. And those have a positive influence on some communities around the state. The retirees tend to move to Central Oregon, coastal communities, and then Southern Oregon, right? So they're spreading out across the state a little bit differently than the young folks, which are disproportionately moving to our urban centers. But the retirees bring with them a lifetime of experience and some wealth, sometimes in the form of California home equity, and they're voting with their feet saying, we want to be a part of your community. So overall, it's a very positive development for our regional economies. Lastly, on the migration, international migration, it's in the news. It's a big topic of discussion at the federal level right now. Right now, about 10% of the Oregon residents are foreign-born, whether that is legal status or illegal status. It's about 10%. It's a little less than the U.S. A large chunk of the overall foreign-born population does come from Mexico. It's a sizable share. Most of these migrants came in the 1990s and the 1990s and the 2000s, less so since the Great Recession. We've seen international migration, particularly from Latin America, shrivel up with an underperforming U.S. economy and a Latin American economy that has been doing better. So the job opportunities are disproportionately a little bit better in Mexico and in south of the border, at least in recent years.
So to transition into trade, it's pretty obvious to probably everyone on this panel that trade is important for Oregon, and we're going to have the port folks follow us up and give you some more detail on this. I spoke before and said that, well, in every post-war expansion, Oregon has outperformed the U.S. as a whole. Well, there was one two- or three-year period where we didn't, and that happened to coincide. That was in the mid-1990s during the Asian financial crisis, when we had a currency shock directly hit some of our supply chains. And so trade is by far more important here than it is in most places, and we're worried about the near-term outlook, not just because of the policy environment, which is certainly very uncertain right now, but also just because of our terms of trade right now, looking at how strong our dollar is, particularly vis-a-vis the countries that Oregon trades with. Here we're looking at the strength of the dollar, the blue line being relative to the mix of currencies that Oregon trades with, and it hasn't been this strong since 2000. And so this is putting downward pressure on the demand for our exports. Now, hopefully, this will improve a little bit going forward. Some of this run-up had to do with the drop in commodity prices and a related decline in the value of a lot of the currencies of emerging and resource economies out in the world. But nevertheless, this probably won't happen overnight, and this wait will be here for some time. And it certainly is important to us. This data is really messy, the export numbers, but looking at export.
I'm going to jump in, pardon me, just for a second. So we've got about three more minutes, and then unfortunately gotcha. We're going to definitely have to transition.
Thank you, Chair. I think we should be able to do it. We're somewhere around 10th in the country if you're looking at just roughly exports as a share of our GDP. And what are they? They tend to be, in terms of value, they tend to be computer and electronic products more than anything. Now, these are exports that are measured in terms of the value of exports, or the dollar value, which really overstates the role that the technology industries play. Because one small bag of chips on an airplane is a tremendous value, sometimes as much as a barge of bulk exports. And so when you hear from the port later, they'll tell you about some more important measures for overall economic activity, the stuff for warehousing and transportation industries and all that ancillary stuff that comes along. But in terms of which countries we sell to, because of our ties with the consumer, our electronic products, it's increasingly become Asia, not surprisingly. And this is... and of course, this is interesting given the federal policy environment. But either way, it's important to note that, you know, just in terms of direct impact, export numbers aren't really that big in terms of just direct impact, but really for any state, including Oregon. It's deeper where they impact in terms of supply chains and the like. And Josh is going to make a couple comments on that, and then we'll go ahead and close.
Just move to that last one. Thanks. Yeah, and so those are a couple confusing scatter plots we'll skip over. But basically what Mark was saying, right, is if you look at these level of exports as a share of the Oregon economy, it doesn't matter which country you're talking about or even for that matter which state you're talking about. The direct trade exposure to, say, Mexico or direct trade exposure to China as a share of the state economy is very, very small. And so to the extent that we have some sort of very narrow-focused trade war potentially or renegotiations or what have you, the direct impact maybe will be somewhat less. But the real issue when it comes to trade and if we have any sort of disruptions and it'll take a while to readjust to a new environment should it come to pass, is the overall supply chain, right? The supply chain has moved global in the last 20 years. And every major industry, every major manufacturing industry, which you see here, imports a certain percentage of the inputs they use in their manufacturing process, right? Even if you have an appliance manufacturer here in the U.S., maybe they're using a particular washing machine valve from Taiwan, or a paper mill uses one of the machines in the paper-making process they import from Germany, right? Even though almost all of the value add and all the production occurs here on our shores or in our state, part of the goods they rely on come from an import or some supplier overseas. And so this just tries to get at some of the different industries, what share of your intermediate goods, your input goods, are imported into the U.S. from abroad. And so to the extent that we have some sort of trade disruption, there's the potential to see some gunking up of the overall supply chains. And again, it's a little bit broader than, again, any sort of trade relations with a particular country. We're talking about something potentially a little more broadening than just that.
Okay. Great. So look at that, your contact information. I love that graphic. Rep. Gomberg has a question, and then we're going to thank you and perhaps have you come back soon.
Thank you so much. Good morning, Madam Chair. And I want to go back, gentlemen, to all the way to slide number one. If the answer to this question is too long, I'll be happy to get it in writing from you later. But my question is this. First of all, this reflects non-farm employment. Many of us here represent rural communities. I'm interested in how this graph might change if we include the agriculture sector. The other question I've got for you is that we also describe ourselves as an economy of small businesses. And many small business owners are, in fact, employees of their company, but many employers don't have employees. They're sole proprietors, they're entrepreneurs. I know the numbers are smaller than the agriculture sector, but how might that affect these charts?
Yeah, Chair Leininger, Representative Gomberg. I'll be happy to connect with you and give you some of the more differently defined employment. Unfortunately, this one in front of you, the payroll employment, misses both of those things. Both our huge agriculture sector, which is doing well relative to most in this particular business cycle, but also, as with manufacturing, is a very boom-bust experience and is very seasonal and brings in a lot of seasonal workers. But this misses both those and the self-employed workers. This is the payroll survey where the employment department knocks on doors of businesses and says, how many people do you have working for you? There are two others, in particular the household survey, where they go and knock on doors of houses and say, do you have a job? And that's where you pick up more of the good self-employment things and the like.
All right. I so appreciate that. So it sounds like we've got a good action item for follow-up. If you could provide us with some supplemental information that incorporates agricultural and small business contributions, that'd be great. And with that, thank you both so much for being here. You always do a great job.
Thanks for having us. Sorry about the information overload.
No, this was great. I think I should have scheduled you to have more time because it's wonderful material. All right, and next we have some additional wonderful presenters. We have Keith Levitt and Catherine Williams from the Port of Portland, who are going to give us just a very top-line read on some of the crucial issues affecting economic development in Oregon that are within their bailiwick, specifically port issues, a super brief primer on what the Portland Harbor site means, and some thoughts on trade. And again, we may invite you to come back later because we are running a little late. Thanks.
Good morning, Chair Leininger, members of the committee. My name is Catherine Williams. I'm the State Affairs Manager for the Port of Portland. I'm going to quickly turn it over to our Chief Commercial Officer, Keith Levitt, but just wanted to introduce myself, and hopefully today we will sort of whet the committee's appetite to all the ways that the Port of Portland plays in both economic and trade in the state of Oregon. So with that, I'll turn it over to Keith.
Great. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Again, I'm Keith Levitt, Chief Commercial Officer with Port of Portland. We have a fair amount of content, and I promise to whip through it as efficiently as possible. Move to the next slide here.
And I think in the interest of trying to regain some of our timeliness, we're going to transition at quarter till, so you've got 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Oh, we're good.
Sorry. Perfect. think we'll...
And I will not belabor this slide. You just heard good content from the prior presenters. Going to the next slide, the Port of Portland. Our mission, the way we view our mission, is to really be a portal for trade. It goes to, I love that supply chain slide that the previous presenters just had. We have three lines of business. You know, aviation and marine are really oriented towards being that portal for trade, for the movement of commerce, for the movement of people to global markets. Our industrial land mission is really all about having land available for traded sector companies to grow and expand and grow the trade base. Just moving quickly into our lines of business, we've been very focused on international air service. The airport has grown a lot in passenger growth. We're at a little over 18 million passengers this year. If I were here 4 years ago showing you our international air service connections, we'd pretty much just have two. The Narita flight to Tokyo and then the Delta flight to Amsterdam. We've grown a lot of European service since that time. We're about to launch our London Heathrow service this May, which is very exciting. It's the largest European market that we were unable to serve. You know, why is this important? We have a lot of companies in our state that want that direct access, or at least access from Portland to an international hub within Asia or Europe where they can then move to their facilities or offices in those areas. We have about 135 Japanese companies, for instance, in the Portland area that very much want that Narita flight to stay. We've been very focused on cargo. So you hear a lot about the T6 issues. I'll touch on that. Very similarly, we've been challenged as a fairly small consumer market to draw air carrier service that provides all cargo access between Asia and PDX. We were lucky over the last couple of years to work with world-class carrier Cathay Pacific. They started their service a few months ago. It's 2 days a week. The anchor tenants, if you will, of that service, this is 100% exports from Oregon. The seafood industry, the perishable ag industry, the Nike air soles, which is the only thing Nike manufactures in the U.S., done in Beaverton, and Intel and other high-tech components will take advantage of those flights. Moving to the next slide. I'm going to shift gears here and talk about the working waterfront. We could probably spend the whole day talking about this, so I'll try to be brief. This is probably one of the most underappreciated economic drivers in our state. Some 65,000 direct, indirect, and induced jobs occur daily in this geography here. This is the same geography as the Superfund area for the Lower Willamette. It's about a 10-mile stretch from the Broadway Bridge to the confluence. There's some 10 international terminals, four of which are owned by the Port of Portland, but six of which are in private sector hands. We have a significant steel industry with Schnitzer, with Evraz, Oregon Steel. We have a lot of manufacturing, a lot of transportation service providers, and these are the jobs that are those middle-income jobs that we covet in our community. They pay above $50,000 per year on average. I'll just move to the next. And, you know, why is that area as vibrant as it has been historically? It's because of the transportation advantages that we have. We truly have a multimodal hub in Portland owing to the BN and UP, the rail geography that moves at Rivergate through the Cascade Mountains. It allows for a funnel of exports from the Midwest of the U.S. These are agriculture products grown in the U.S. and exported out of Portland. We have an upriver system that extends all the way to Lewiston, Idaho, 465 miles from the ocean. We have a deep draft navigation system that moves 105 miles from the ocean into Portland. We have pretty good interstate access both the east and west, north and south along the west coast. So it's a multimodal hub. I'm going to just, this highlights the rail capture region. You know, when we think of our gateway status as an organization, as a port, we're really looking into Canada, the Midwest of the U.S., the Pacific Northwest, and in Oregon. So it's a very broad geographic region that the rail system really provides to us. Drilling further into our businesses, so we're a diversified marine port. That actually has served us well. Most of our terminals are under long-term lease with private operators. In any given year, we are usually one or two on the West Coast for autos. We have Toyota imports, Honda, Hyundai imports. We also have Ford exports, Fords that are manufactured in the Midwest and railed here and then exported to China. We've been doing very well with autos. Grain had a huge year last year off a couple of low years. That's why you see such a disparity there with the growth in grain. Mineral bulks, we have at Terminal 5, Canadian potash. This is used in food production all over the world. It's a fertilizer. It's mined out of Saskatoon, comes here via unit train from Canada. We also have soda ash mined out of Wyoming, used in making glass. It's what makes glass transparent. Those are our large mineral bulks that, again, flow through the Port of Portland, owing really to that rail system. We'll move to the next slide to talk about the container issues, and I won't cover all these bullets. I know a lot of you have heard a lot about that issue. There are really two fundamental challenges that we have with our container terminal. One is the changes in the industry. We don't really control that. The carriers in globally are going through a reformation, if you will. There's a glut of capacity on the market. There are ships that are huge and have provided a lot of new capacity. Rates have gone irrationally low, and you see carriers going under. Hanjin was the first. They're not going to be the last. There's a lot of consolidating to do in that industry. It's a lot like the airline industry was 10 years ago. And so we're on our way to the next couple of years seeing, I think, a lot more consolidations occurring. The challenge for Portland is going to be when the dust settles on the industry, what types of vessels actually can make it up the Columbia River. The vessel sizes keep getting bigger and bigger, and I think our marketing niche gets more narrow. It's easy for carriers to serve Portland out of Seattle and Tacoma, and that's a challenge to our shippers, and we've been focused on that. The other fundamental challenge is more on the ground. It's the labor management issues that I'm sure you've heard a lot about. Those issues are still unresolved. They're in the D.C. Circuit Court right now being litigated. They go to jurisdiction. The ILWU, do they get jurisdiction over the plugging and unplugging of refrigerated containers? That for 40 years has been in the domain of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. That fundamentally was the labor jurisdiction dispute that started a lot of tension between the operator, ICTSI, who has a lease with us, and the ILWU, and that affected productivity for many years at the terminal. Both those issues need resolution before, frankly, we're going to have success in marketing to carriers to come back into Portland. I'll move to the next slide. This is a good just takeaway slide. It talks about our imports and exports. Moving quickly to industrial land, again, I won't cover all these bullets. They're good takeaways. The port is the largest holder of industrial real estate in the state. We have largely built out what I'll call our historic land supply. And if you move to the next slide, it shows Rivergate, Swan Island. Those are the major industrial hubs of activity. They're in that lower Willamette area that you saw earlier. They're fairly well built out at this point. So we have been acquiring real estate over the last several years. We've invested some $70 million in East Multnomah County, both in Troutdale, the Troutdale Reynolds industrial site. This is the largest brownfield that we've done in the state of Oregon. It's been a great learning, I think, for a lot of us. We have needed the help of state government and federal government, both regulators and funders, to help make sense of a very complex site. But I'm happy to say that we're just about to launch into offering another 180 acres to the market in our phase two. And we have a lot of takers on a lot of that property, and I think you'll hear more about that. Gresham also is another area that we've been focused on in East Multnomah County. The acreages that are available here, we need to update this slide. Because of this economy that we're in, we've now taken down a lot of that property, and we're starting to see the end, and we need to look at reinvesting in acquisitions. This is our last slide. The major issues for us, it's really on the international air service side. Instead of expansion, it's retention. We've enjoyed a lot of expansion. Now we need to retain. The great economic slides that we saw earlier about the state of the economy always worry me. That we're about to hit a cycle. Hopefully the growth continues, but retention is going to be a key. Talk about Terminal 6. One of the issues that we face is financial constraints. At the Port of Portland, our largest business is the airport. We can't use any airport revenue or any funds at all from the airport to fund marine, industrial, or Superfund. So all of that gets put on the general fund of the port. That makes that fund highly constrained. So that's a big issue for us as we look into the future, is how do you fund the cleanup potential liability that's out there while also continuing to invest in the marine and industrial sides of our business.
Do we have any questions for these good people, recognizing it's a quick overview here in our first opportunity to have a conversation with them? Rep Clem.
I'm obviously happy to see Cathay as another Asian route for cargo, but do we have any discussions about passenger to China, for example, or, you know, Hong Kong? I'm sure we're not going to go direct to Singapore like San Francisco just started doing on United, but any passenger places other than Narita?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Clem, we do keep a very close eye on daily passengers each way. It's a term that is used in the industry. The airlines know that when we come to talk to them, we have to show the analytics that says we actually have the market demand to support a flight. China has been right on the edge. So Shanghai, we're probably within a few years, particularly with technology, with different types of planes, where we could make a play both in China as well as potentially in Hong Kong. It's always close.
And can I follow up? And does the metric only count if they came, let's say, from Shanghai to Portland with a connector in San Francisco? That would count. But if they went Shanghai to San Francisco, worked for a couple days, then bought a domestic ticket to Portland, it wouldn't count?
That happens a lot.
It happened to three of my friends did it yesterday from China, literally.
And I do think I'm not totally sure about the last part of the scenario, the last part, but we have a very good consultant that we work with who is able to track when you leave the Portland area, no matter when you ultimately come back to the Portland area, you could hit several airports, but we still can track that when we look at our the analytics that we show airlines for demand for direct air service.
One more really fast.
Yes, and then we're going to transition.
Okay.
Thank you.
Are they checking more outbound than inbound?
They're checking both.
All right. Thank you so much. I think, personally, I would love to hear much more about how we can support the great trade work that you're doing, but I know we're time limited, and so I'm grateful that you've come here to give us a quick overview of some of the broad scope of your docket.
Thank you.
All right. So in the last two meetings, we've talked about what state agencies, the role that state agencies have in supporting economic development and job growth and trade. And now we're going to transition to some of our key partners, and that's what we're going to do for the rest of the meeting. We're going to hear from a panel of federal agencies about ways that they participate in economic development and trade growth. Then we're going to hear from some local agency folks, and then crucially, we're going to hear from some NGOs, some trade association advocacy groups, and those are regular people who have come here to be with us today. And so I want to make sure that we give them plenty of time to say what they need to say. So with this, I'd like to invite the federal agencies and thank them for being here. Jill Reese, Acting State Director of USDA, Lisa Cizanop, Business and Cooperative Program Director, USDA Rural Development Office, and Martin Golden, District Director of U.S. Small Business Administration, to come forward. We're going to need to be finished with this panel by 5 minutes after. So if you could each take, 3-4 minutes to give us a quick overview of your work, and then we'll have a couple minutes for questions, that'd be great.
Sure.
Thank you for being here.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much for allowing me to be here today. It's always exciting to talk about the SBA. So I've got a presentation that I know is longer than 10 minutes, so I'm going to whip through it pretty quick. And if you have any questions.
Yeah. We have about 3 or 4 minutes for your presentation.
All right.
So thank you.
Well, I'll have to whip through it real quick.
Yeah.
So that's me. The SBA is a relatively small agency, about 2,400 people. All the program offices are headquartered in D.C. We have loan processing centers throughout the country. We have 68 district offices nationwide. I'm the leader of the district office, which covers most of Oregon and Southwest Washington. You can see here where we are. We're not covering the eastern part of Oregon. That's covered by Boise. And we cover Southwest Washington, mainly the Vancouver MSA. So the major thing that we do is what I call 3C³E, which is access to capital, federal contracting, counseling, and then export as well. So on the capital side, which is probably the most famous thing, the SBA provides loan guarantees to banks who then will lend out the money to small businesses who may not be able to access capital on their own. So we provide 75, in most cases, 75 or 85% guarantees, which hopefully incentivizes them. We take 75% of the loss if there's a loss. We do not offer any grants to business owners. We have no direct loans to business owners except for disaster loans, which I can talk about if you have an interest. We do that mainly through our 7(a) loan guarantee program, which is done for working capital and purchase of businesses. Their fees are a little bit higher than they might be for a regular bank loan, which is why it's preferable to go to a bank if you can, in fact, qualify. One good thing is we have zero fees for businesses under $150,000. That program's been around for about 3 years. And for veterans, that you get free fees up to $350,000. We have a second program that's mostly, if you think about somebody who may be buying the building they're manufacturing in, they'll get a 504 loan. They tend to be bigger. They can be up to $12.5 million in total deal size. The SBA will take a second position in that case, and the business owner will have to come up with about 10% down instead of 20 or 30% down. We have a microloan program that we arrange through intermediaries. Intermediaries in this district are MISO, Alami, and Mercy Corps Northwest. These are small loans up to about $50,000, often to less creditworthy individuals, and it comes with a mix of technical assistance as well. It's also more expensive at 8% above cost of funds, but that's a little better than a credit card if you have one. And we track some of the numbers we track. Our loan numbers here, we track loans to minorities, women, and veterans, as well as other folks. I think there's a couple interesting slides here. You can see the trend in lending over the last 10 years. 1239 recognizes the last good year before the Great Recession. Pops up in 10 because we started doing zero upfronts. That went away. And then you see a gradual increase. This last year was the first time that it's dropped a little bit in the last 8 years. On the loan size, though, in total amounts lent, we've been on a steady increase up to the record $456 million last year in 16. Turning to the contracting side, the major point there is that we help people try to connect into the federal supply chain. Uncle Sam's the largest purchaser of goods and services in the world. We have two major programs that we do that through. One is called an 8A Business Development Program for socially disadvantaged individuals. It's an 8-year program. We have a hub zone program for people who live in historically underutilized business zones. So if you have a company in one of those zones, then you have access to those contracts as well. We also have programs aimed at women-owned, economically disadvantaged women-owned, veteran, and service-disabled veterans businesses as well. I'm not going to go through this given the pressure on time. We in the SBA office here do training there. Okay, I think maybe the most important thing that is less known about the SBA is the counseling and training that we help to arrange. We quarterback. So we have a SCORE network with 11,000 SCORE counselors nationwide. They're all volunteers. We have 5 chapters here in this district. We have small business development centers that are operated under contract with the SBA in every state in the country. It's operated here through Lane Community College. We have 19 centers in Oregon and 2 in Vancouver. We also have a women's business center that's operated by Women's Mercy Corps Northwest here in Portland. They can help with all sorts of things from planning businesses to helping get capital to figuring out how to exit a business if you're successful. We have a lot of training online. Again, I think if there's one thing I can get out here, it's there's a lot of resources available to small businesses that they don't know about and will be helpful. And it's all free for the most part.
So I'm going to ask you to just wrap up in the next minute. And yep. Luckily, we've got some good small business development center legislation that we're going to be looking at further. And so hopefully we'll be able to seek expertise from your team going forward.
Absolutely. So I have a minute to go, so I got a minute here. You've heard many times about the importance of exports. The main point I want to make here is the vast majority of people who export, 98% of exporting companies are small. And one-third of exports come from small businesses. So it's very important to small businesses, and a lot of business owners should keep that in mind. It's a good market for them. We have three loan programs under the export side to help people who are either trying to get overseas or who may even be being affected by somebody coming in. So.
Hey, that's great. And thank you for the comprehensive presentation that we can refer back to. That's really helpful. Welcome to our next speaker.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Jill Reese. I'm with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, or USDA. I currently serve as the Acting State Director overseeing the Oregon operations of the three agencies that comprise USDA's Rural Development Mission Area: the Rural Housing Service, the Rural Utility Service, and the Rural Business and Cooperative Service. Joining me today is Lisa Seasonop, the Oregon Program Director for USDA's Business and Cooperative Programs. USDA's Rural Development Mission Area is dedicated to improving the economy and quality of life in rural America through more than 40 programs designed to help rural communities grow and prosper. In federal fiscal year 2016, USDA Rural Development invested nearly $584 million in rural Oregon through our housing, infrastructure, community, and business programs. Since 2009, this assistance to rural Oregon amounts to over $4.7 billion. A significant portion of our funding is delivered in the form of direct and guaranteed loans to help low to moderate income rural Americans purchase safe, affordable housing in rural areas. We also offer loans and grants to help rural residents make health and safety repairs to their homes. In fiscal year 16, we helped 2,100 Oregon families purchase or repair their homes with $378.4 million in USDA financing assistance. We also administer loans and grants for the development and rehabilitation of affordable rental housing for very low, low, and moderate income residents, the elderly, and persons with disabilities. Currently, 211 USDA finance department complexes are providing affordable rental housing for more than 6,300 rural Oregon families across the state. Of those, nearly 5,700 qualified low-income families last year received USDA rental assistance to keep housing costs at not more than 30% of their household income. Both our single-family and multifamily housing programs are available in rural communities where decent, affordable, and workforce housing is often scarce, affecting not only families but also rural businesses seeking to attract and retain a skilled workforce. Our programs also support the community infrastructure that helps make rural communities great places to live and do business. In recent years, USDA Rural Development's Community Facilities Loan and Grant Program assisted 60 rural Oregon communities with the construction or rehabilitation of schools, healthcare facilities, fire stations, and other essential community facilities that are critical in supporting rural economies. Infrastructure is another building block for rural economic development and business expansion. USDA Rural Development invests in rural utility systems that help improve and expand the rural electrical grid, provide clean drinking water to rural communities, and deliver increased internet service to rural families and businesses, allowing them to compete in today's economy. In 2016, we provided $17.4 million in loans and grants across rural Oregon to support new or improved water and wastewater service necessary for health, safety, and sustainable economies. Through our Rural Business and Cooperative Programs Division, we also administer a number of programs that provide direct support to help rural businesses get started, expand, and innovate. While housing, community facility, and infrastructure programs have different rural eligibility requirements, our business programs are generally available in non-metro communities with a population of 50,000 or less.
You know, I'm going to jump in. Thank you so much. It sounds like you have a written presentation. Mm-hmm. If you could submit that to us, then we will be able to read it also. And since we have pretty limited time, what I'd love to have you do is maybe take the next minute to add any additional points that you wanted to make, and then we can open it up for questions about the SBA program and rural development. Did you have comments that you were also going to make, or are you two here together as a team?
We're here together as a team.
Great.
So I was going to cover the rural business programs as well.
Great. If you could just in sort of a minute speak that would
you
be
betcha.
Helpful.
So in our business programs, we have a significant loan guarantee program similar to the SBA program, but we specialize in rural communities. We have people on the ground out in the more remote areas, so there's access to this type of assistance is different. We work with rural lenders. Through our business and industry program, we basically increase access to business capital and bolster the existing private credit structure. Last year, we did $86.2 million in rural Oregon. Since 2009, that's $374 million across the state for rural business development. We also have programs that serve smaller loans through intermediaries, through relending programs. We have a few grant programs in our business programs for technical assistance, also for value-added producer production. So all of our great, vast agricultural and forest products, we provide significant grant funding to help those become bigger income generators for Oregon with the value add here in Oregon. Last year, we did $1.9 million in grants to, I believe, 12 producers in Oregon. Those are having significant job benefits in rural Oregon. I think also I'd like to say we also have rural energy programs. So we do have assistance, financing, and some grants for the addition of renewable energy and energy efficiency with rural businesses, farms, ranches. And we also support the production of biofuels through our programs. I think the key point I think we'd like to make is that our funding is significant in rural Oregon, but it's not nearly enough, and we really rely on our partnerships with state agencies, as well as philanthropy, nonprofits, the private sector. So all of those strategies that we have, we're very dependent on this collective work, weaving together the programs of federal, state, and others to deliver a comprehensive suite of assistance in rural Oregon. We'd like to see that continue, definitely, and find new strategies to encourage more privately leveraged investments.
That's a great point. Do we have questions? I think Rep. Brock Smith, looks like you have a question about the housing work that RD does is so important. So thank you. It's a great economic driver too.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment, Mrs. Reese, it's good to see you.
You too.
And the Rehome Oregon project that we worked on together, and mm-hmm. you kind of touched, I think, briefly on it when it expanded earlier, has been so important for rural Oregon, and the dollars, therefore, that come to rural Oregon to assist. And I appreciate Vicki Walker and former director and all of her work as well, former representative and senator for the state. So I'm glad for your presentation. I'm sorry we didn't have more time to talk about more, but
thank you.
Future.
Rep. Gomberg also has a question.
Thank you for the time, Madam Chair. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for what you do for our communities and for our economy. My question is this. I've got a great business opportunity, but I don't have any collateral. I don't have any equity. I don't have a home that I can factor into it. How easy is it for me to get a loan from you guys?
So in a case like this, we would probably
introduce yourself for the record first, and then
I'm sorry. I'm Marisa Seasonup, USDA Rural Development with the business programs. What we would probably do is we would either have you work with actually the SBDCs, the technical assistant providers that Martin mentioned with SBA. Those are really handy, and what they could do is help you kind of get a business plan in place, maybe work out your strategy. But we do, our programs do require collateral, some level of equity. So we're kind of at that. That's why I think a critical point is having these either private, nonprofit, NGOs around that can kind of help fill the gap of where someone is before they could get commercial lending.
Madam Chair, if I could just say, you want to start a business and you got money, you can get money to keep your business going. But we need to talk about how to help folks that have got great opportunities but no equity.
Right. Did you also want to add a comment to that?
Marty Golden with the SBA. My comments would be fairly similar. The SBA programs are designed when there's under-collateralization, and a lot of it has to do with whether you're talking to the right lender. Often we find people go to the right, wrong lender within an organization. It helps to the SBA to talk with the SBA to maximize your chances. But in a situation where you have no equity, no collateral, and are extremely unbankable, you know, the SBA is probably not going to be able to help.
The good news is that Representative Gomberg may have some legislative ideas that we can consider to think about productive next steps.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, I'm certainly not trying to undermine their good work. I'm just trying to point out one place where we've got a weakness in our current offerings.
Right. And I think the theme we heard from our good presenters is that we've got to work together to try to strengthen the continuum of help. And so it's wonderful to identify potential openings. So thank you for that. Any other questions for these good people before we transition? Thanks a lot for being here. And thanks for your patience as we manage through a kind of overly crowded docket for today.
Thank you very much.
For which I take full responsibility in defense of my good colleague. All right. So next we are going to hear from our local economic development agencies. And for this part, we're going to hear from Kristen Rutherford, who's the immediate past president of the Oregon Economic Development Association, talking about supports that local government entities can do. Oh, good. And we also have Chad Freeman. I wasn't sure. Maybe I need to flip the page. Supports that local governments provide. I'm going to ask you to try to present for no more than 10 minutes total. We'll ask a few questions, and then we'll thank you very much for being here today.
No problem. We can easily meet that timeline. All right. Thank you. And good morning, and thank you for having us here this morning.
And I just to be clear, this whole panel needs to take no more than 15 minutes total. Yep. So thanks.
I'm Kristen Rutherford, and I am the immediate past president of both the Oregon Economic Development Association and the Association of Oregon Redevelopment Agencies. My day job is here in Salem as the Urban Development Director for the City of Salem. With me today is Mr. Chad Freeman, who is the president of the Strategic Economic Development Corporation, who is our private sector partner in economic development here in Salem. He also serves as the governmental chair's the chair for OEDA. So this morning, I'm going to speak with you about what we do as economic development practitioners and what we need. And Chad is going to be here to help with questions and to represent the private sector side of things. OEDA is a statewide nonprofit organization that supports economic development professionals who are on the front line in economic development work and diversifying and expanding Oregon's economy. Our membership includes about 120 local, regional, and state economic development agencies that represent both public and private sector organizations like SEDCOR and PGE. AORA also works in the field of economic development, but its focus is using urban renewal to build and revitalize our communities and economies. AORA represents about 40 urban renewal agencies engaged in economic development and improving quality of life around the state. Those of us that work in this field do so because we believe in the value of investing in jobs and in job creation, and know that this leads to growth in income tax revenues that benefit the state budget and the quality of life of our communities. As practitioners, our economic development efforts focus on business recruitment, business retention and expansion, and growing traded sector employment throughout the state. There is no single definition of economic development and no single strategy that we all adhere to or policy or program for achieving success in economic development. What works in LaGrand for my colleagues there will be different than what works for my colleagues in Hillsborough. So we need tools and resources that can be adapted locally. That said, most of our economic development efforts focus on traded sector business growth, which produces goods and services that are used outside of the region. To grow traded sector jobs in our communities, we need industrial land that is served with infrastructure and ready for development. Many of our communities use urban renewal financing for this purpose and also make use of brownfield grants and state funding through the Infrastructure Financing Authority. Those are all tools that are very important to us. We also need a workforce that is educated and trained. Access to workforce has been a top five consideration cited by site selectors for several years now, and it is often the first or second consideration in selecting a business location. When we meet with companies, that's always one of the first things that they bring up when we talk with them. Incentives are another top consideration for businesses. Our members use urban renewal, enterprise zones, and other state programs like the Strategic Reserve Fund to help local businesses expand, to retain them from moving out of state, and to attract new businesses to the state. We compete for our jobs nationally and internationally, and competitive incentives really do matter. Like workforce, they always come up in our conversations. Policy changes that would require prevailing wage for enterprise zone benefits would make the limited tools that we have much less effective. Our members work closely with each other locally, regionally, and at state levels. And to do our jobs well, we need support from the state. Because Business Oregon can do a lot of things that we cannot do. Business Oregon can market Oregon to the world and execute on global trade and investment strategies that we can't do locally. It can promote Oregon agriculture and manufacturing products and services that are sold in global markets. It can lead where municipalities and regions cannot on international business development, marketing, and policy. Most of us at the local level do not have funding for international trade efforts or to attend national trade shows or to visit site selectors. We rely on Business Oregon for this. And here's another example. So our colleagues in Coos Bay or Redmond, we can't operate a trade office in Japan or in Europe. However, we do have several international businesses in our communities throughout the state and our trade partners that provide us with opportunities for additional investment and job growth. It's important to us throughout the state to maintain the state's international relationships and our marketing presence overseas. At the local level, Business Oregon's business development officers can help us by being creative partners. Our BDOs have a picture of resources around the state that we don't have at the local level. It's critical to have their participation in discussions with corporate leadership when we're working with companies that are considering leaving our communities or in attracting businesses to our communities. If a colleague in Klamath Falls needs help beefing up an electric or natural gas service to land a company, the state BDO needs to be available. They're going to be a critical part of that conversation. And their conduit to the governor can be extremely helpful when we're dealing with national and international decision makers. They give us more credibility. And also when we have negotiations with companies that have some sort of policy implication. We need BDOs that have a business mindset and that understand business timelines. And we need simple process and quick turnaround times for incentives like the Strategic Reserve Fund. Our clients can't wait 6 to 9 months for a commitment. It doesn't fit into the business model and their timelines. So we lose jobs when time and onerous process get in the way. So we also need ongoing development of statewide marketing tools and access to Business Oregon marketing materials. We benefit tremendously from their materials. At the local level, most of us don't have access to our own economists or access to graphic designers. And so the ability to go to the Business Oregon website and download those materials so that we can share them with our clients is very, very helpful to us out there on the front lines. Finally, we need continued investment in infrastructure and site readiness and continuation of existing incentive programs, the preservation of urban renewal as a tool for local economic development, and we need to enhance the toolbox of economic development programs that encourage investment in traded sector industries. Proposed legislation like House Bill 2470 would have damaging impacts on the use of urban renewal to assist in local economic development, as would proposed legislation to subject enterprise zones to prevailing wage. With state funding challenges, those of us working in local and regional economic development are well aware that we will need to step up and fill that gap where possible. And we would be happy to engage in greater partnership with the state and develop new models for pursuing economic development activities and recruitment efforts. The Team Oregon program that OEDA has recently developed in partnership with Business Oregon is just one such model. This is a pay-to-play program that is available to businesses and local, regional, and state economic development partners to pool our resources, to invest in pre-qualified leads, and to market Oregon at national trade shows that focus on advanced manufacturing and food processing. This program has allowed us to come together and leverage our resources to have a greater impact on the national level. So we look forward to exploring more creative opportunities like Team Oregon in the future. And I want to thank you for the time, your time, and the opportunity to share all of this with you this morning. And we are both very happy to answer any questions you might have. Thanks.
That's great. Thank you so much. As a former county commissioner, and I'm sitting next to a former county commissioner and city councilor, it's really interesting to hear the local government perspective, or I just think it's a crucial perspective. And I do know that we have a couple of bills in the committee this session that will be perhaps good conversation points as we decide how we can support economic development. Any questions for these good people regarding the local role in economic development and trade? All right. For right now, it looks like we're good. Thank you so much. And we're going to transition to our last you can go ahead and sit down. We're going to transition to our last two panels of individuals who work in the trade association, nonprofit economic development sector, and I'm really delighted that you could be here with us today. Our first panel is going to include advocacy organization reps Betsy Earls from AOI and DJ Vogt from Oregon Business Association, and then we will have our final panel, which is Skip Newberry, Executive Director of the Technology Association of Oregon, and Jonathan Kalan Montesi, which I may have mispronounced, so I hope someone will correct me, the interim co-president of the Hispanic Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce. And I think it's important for us to realize we have a really rich assortment of culturally specific and industry specific and regional advocacy organizations we work with. So welcome. You do not seem to have DJ next to you, but
I don't
we are
seem to have DJ.
We're particularly excited to see you since you're our only panelist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm particularly excited to be here, and AOI, and I know OBA, who's probably still in transit, so much appreciate the opportunity to speak with you this morning. For those of you that I haven't met in particular, I'm looking forward to getting to know you and
can you
telling you about AOI.
Would you mind introducing yourself again for the record?
No problem. Okay. Betsy Earls, thanks. Representing Associated Oregon Industries. So, and I'm Vice President and Counsel at AOI, and I work with a couple other colleagues, Mike Fries, who you probably know, who does environment, energy, transportation work. So just to give you a little background on AOI, AOI is a member-driven advocacy organization, and we work to build sound public policy on behalf of the Oregon business community. AOI represents the business community before the Oregon legislature, as well as in state agencies and state agency rulemaking. We do not work at the local level. We're founded in 1895, and AOI represents over 1,500 member companies, which provide roughly 200,000 jobs for Oregonians. So our members cover a great deal of the waterfront, as it were, in terms of employing Oregonians. Our members are very diverse. Approximately 50% of our members have fewer than 25 employees, so we are essentially a small business organization. Another 18% have between 26 and 50 workers. Only a quarter of our members have more than 50 employees, but those include most of the largest companies in Oregon. Members are spread very evenly across the state and engage in varied industries. Our biggest industry category is manufacturing, and that's followed by retail wholesale, and, of course, service providers and others. We represent our members in seven distinct policy areas, and you'll be hearing about those in the weeks to come. We work in education and workforce development, labor and employment law, which is an area I particularly deal with, environment and energy, fiscal policy, healthcare, transportation, and retail affairs. And that's another one that I spend a lot of time on, retailers. Our policies are determined entirely through our membership, through committee, and those membership committees forward recommendations to the AOI board. So although there is some staff involvement in helping frame those conversations, they're entirely member-driven. AOI is the Oregon affiliate of the United States Chamber of Commerce, the National Association of Manufacturers, the Council of State Chambers, the National Retail Federation, and the Council of State Retail Associations. Good morning, DJ.
Good morning.
Besides our work in public policy, there is one other thing I wanted to tell you about AOI's involvement in the community. And if you have high school students or you know high school students, you should pay particular attention here. AOI is a founding partner of a group called the Young Entrepreneurs Business Week, through which we're working to build the next generation of business leaders. And I am particularly involved in this program. It is a great deal of fun. YEBW is an immersive one-week business camp for high school students. We hold it three separate times each summer on different college campuses, so U of O, Oregon State, and I believe University of Portland most years. We start the program, it's a three-year program, so we start with Business Week the first year, in which students learn the basics of running a business and develop their own entrepreneurial ideas while they're practicing networking and, if you can imagine when you're 16, business etiquette skills. It's usually my favorite part. The second year of the program, when they supposedly have those etiquette skills, they concentrate on investing and the markets. And the third year of the program, called Entrepreneur Week, is directed toward students that have their own entrepreneurial ideas and are ready to launch. It helps them get those ready. It's sort of like an incubator for high school students. And there have actually been several products launched out of this program. The bulk of the volunteers that run YEBW are from the business community. We use approximately 90 volunteers in each of 3 weeks, and about 50 guest speakers. And student tuition is heavily subsidized by the Oregon business community. Students pay about half of the price of their week there. So I checked before I came here, and I believe every single one of your districts has high schools represented in YEBW, but we do need to focus on sort of the middle of the state. So to the extent that you know high school students there or anywhere else, we would like to hear about them.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's wonderful. Welcome to my neighbor and friend and colleague, DJ Vogt. We are inviting both of you to describe a little bit about your organization's work, and it would be helpful, I think, given the recent developments in teamwork between the organizations, if you could also describe some of the go-forward plans there.
Great. Well, Chair Langer, thank you. For the record, DJ Vogt with the Oregon Business Association and to be named organization later, NewCo, code word, as we're calling it right now. I apologize for being a bit tardy. I'm on point to get our kids to school this morning, and traffic was a little slow on I-5 South. So, in any case, the Oregon Business Association, as it currently exists, is a membership-based business organization. We are about 250-260 members to date, ranging from the largest employers in the state to literally one-man shops, consulting-type businesses. We are geographically diverse, probably more concentrated in the Portland metro area than AOI is or traditionally has been. And well, we do similar work on the advocacy front. OBA has traditionally focused almost exclusively on advocacy versus having products and services like AOI has had with workers' comp, health insurance, and programs like the Young Entrepreneurs. That's not the OBA model. So with that, I can try to comment on the go-forward plan. As at least that we know to date. So as you may have heard, this merger will legally become effective July 1. However, with practical purposes, particularly for a legislative agenda, we are one organization. There will be one policy agenda across all the different policy areas. You will see co-branded materials once we get our boards to finalize materials and we can publish things. They will be co-branded, whether it be policy statements, floor letters, you name it. So we'll be dividing up our labor between the five of us in the building for government affairs purposes, two of us from OBA and two and a half from AOI. And I can go over those assignments. They're not public yet, but they'll be on paper really soon. And we've been describing it, and I don't know if Betsy got into that, who's covering which areas. But
I talked about just Mike doing energy and environment and labor and employment and retail, so you should carry on from there.
Okay. So fiscal, tax, it'll be myself, J.L. Wilson, who is on contract with AOI. He'll also be working that issue. Healthcare, Betsy and I tag team that. Any healthcare policy work, and our colleague Joel Fisher was be point on education issues, backed up by Betsy, and also general economic development issues. We'll all kind of work that, but Joel's been named to be point on certain things. So tax and fiscal, again, myself and JL, and transportation infrastructure will be Mike with myself playing backup.
Great. Well, thank you. And thanks for speaking to the merger of the good work of both organizations. I know that in any merger situation, there's probably a fair amount to be determined. But it's good to have people know your faces. And do we have any questions for these two folks who are really who represent some of the most some of the most significant economic development advocacy, business advocacy voices in the state and statewide. Anybody have any questions for these two? Okay.
We'll be dropping in on you.
That's right. We'll probably check in more and more. All right. Thank you so
thank
much
you, Madam
and
Chair.
Best wishes with the merger and thanks for being here to talk to us.
Thank you.
All right, so our last panel for the day is some additional perspectives in the advocacy arena on behalf of business growth and economic opportunity growth. We have Technology Association of Oregon and Hispanic Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce represented. So if Skip and Jonath could please come forward, that'd be great. Thank you for your patience in waiting through the whole agenda until your opportunity to speak. We're grateful for your work here. And what I would love to have you discuss is sort of where your group or association focuses and things that you'd like to have this committee be thinking about as we try to support more access to economic opportunity for more people in the state. And this is not our last conversation, but hopefully the beginning of some good dialogues.
Great.
Who would like to go first?
Okay. I guess I'm up first. My name is Skip Newberry. I'm president and CEO of the Technology Association of Oregon. To provide some overview, I thought it'd be useful to talk a little bit about some of what we engage in on a day-to-day basis at the association. A big part of that is, of course, advocacy, but it's not the only thing. As an association, we represent a little over 425 technology companies across the state of Oregon, including some in Southwest Washington. We have offices in Portland, in Central Oregon, in Bend, and then also in Eugene. A lot of the companies that we work with are small and medium-sized by Oregon standards. We do work with some of the largest tech companies in the world as well. And we also do a lot of work with what I call tech-enabled companies, so companies that are developing technology products or have large IT infrastructure and rely on the technology industry as a source of innovation and for ideas. In terms of our activities, it can really be broken up into four categories. So with regard to professional networks, that's an area where we provide a lot of programming to different peer groups within our tech company members. We do over 90 events a year just within our professional development programming in the Portland area, a couple of dozen events each year in Eugene, and we just opened the Bend office. We'll probably be doing about 10 events or so there in this next year. In service to helping to train and strengthen the employees and then therefore the companies that we represent in those regions. In terms of the volunteer base of the association, we have, at any given point in time, well over 300 active volunteers pulled from those tech companies. Because the work we do with the companies is multifaceted on a daily and weekly basis, we're able to, in many cases, when it comes to advocacy, draw upon the expertise of our membership and also ask them to essentially show up because we've been able to deliver value to those companies and their employees consistently, in many cases over years. And so apart from professional development and helping to keep their employees trained and up to date We also do a lot of work around industry promotion or storytelling. And there, the focus is on who's here, what are they up to, what does the economic data say about the technology industry, and essentially, why should anyone be paying attention to what's significant about this particular industry and the companies within it. In terms of our advocacy work, we do a lot of work here in Salem as well as at the local level in the areas, especially where we have member companies. We do some work federally, and that's in partnership with an organization that we're a part of called Technology Councils of North America. It's a grassroots network of regional independent tech associations that collectively represents about 25,000 tech companies across the U.S. and Canada. So it's the largest tech network that's grassroots, arguably in the world. In terms of the association and, its impact in Oregon, if we talk for a minute about the size of the technology industry in the state, we did a study last year with one of our counterpart organizations at the federal level called CompTIA. And one thing that they pulled out was that in Oregon, the tech industry accounts for a direct economic impact of 23% on a per capita basis, and that's significant because in California, that number is in the single digits. Granted, California is an enormous economy. I believe it's the fifth largest in the world and overall, but tech plays a less significant role relative to the overall population and relative to the overall size of the economy in that state. This is something, too, that I think is interesting, is if you look at areas of growth within the technology industry in the state, the average wage is more than double the average median wage of all other traded sector industries. There's also a lot of growth going on in terms of payroll and contributions in terms of GDP to the state. We're still largely semiconductor, but one of the areas of growth is software, of course. Over the last decade, we've seen a lot of dynamism there. And this is a significant stat here. If you notice year over year, 2014 to 2015, we saw almost 10,000 new jobs added, just within in large part within software, driving a lot of that. So we hope to see that continued growth continue. That was more significant than to Seattle to our north, as well as some other emerging tier two tech hubs nationally. So a big focus of our organization is on this connection between tech and a sense of place. So as technology companies are looking at where their competitiveness lies within Oregon, it's increasingly a connection to things like infrastructure and quality of life. And this is a reflection of the maturity of the industry here. When I started working with the industry here on economic development issues almost 8 years ago, a lot of the issues were around purely access to capital, and that's it. No one was paying attention. We needed startup funding, and that was it. I think things have evolved now where companies have grown quite a bit. They're looking at how do they grow their workforce? What does the education system look like? Because that's an issue for both recruiting and retaining employees. And then also, what exactly are the amenities that their employees increasingly are looking for when they choose a place to live? It's transportation systems. It's environmental assets. It really runs the gamut. It's arts and culture. And so as these things are clearly now within sort of the competitive advantage of the tech industry, tech is increasingly looking to play a bigger role in helping to support all of these various amenities and assets. And why? Because talent is key for these companies. They don't typically have a lot of capital infrastructure that they're investing in. It's their people. The other interesting thing is you see a lot of migration out of Silicon Valley and other established tech hubs into places like Portland, Bend, Eugene, Hood River, but also a lot of other markets elsewhere around the country that are attractive places to live. So again, a lot of our work as an association is increasingly focused on how do we kind of pull together the assets from within the tech industry and make a positive contribution on the local community. Smart cities is an area that's anticipated to be a $60 trillion opportunity in terms of a global market in the next 15 years. And this is an area where we're doing a lot now to bring both cities as well as other public and academic institutions here to Oregon to learn about what's been going on in transportation and urban planning and innovation there. So last week we hosted a conference with over 300 people from around the world, including over 20 cities here in the Portland area that were coming to learn about what's going on here in terms of innovation. You had small cities like Independence, Oregon that were involved, and they're increasingly looking at different ways that through smart agriculture, another growing market, they can use technology to help increase economic development within their communities. Smart health is another area.
Yep.
That's, sorry. Yes.
If you could wrap up in the next 2 or 3 minutes, that'd be great. and then we'll be sure that we have time for our final presenter.
Fantastic. Thanks. So smart health is another area that's growing rapidly. There's a lot of great growth going on in the state. And here it sits at the intersection with technology, augmented virtual reality and gaming, yet another growth market. Again, there's interesting opportunities where tech is playing an outsized economic role for the state. I mentioned smart ag. And then finally, cybersecurity. Without trust, you really don't have any of this technology. Without this technology, you don't have the economic growth that we're seeing. That's it.
Excellent. So let's move to our final panelist, and then we'll have questions at the end if anybody has questions. Thank you so much for being here today. If you could state your name for the record and then let us know what we should be thinking about, we'd be grateful.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Colone. I am the business development coordinator for the Hispanic Chamber, currently serving as the interim co-president. The Hispanic Chamber is a 23-year organization that was started in Portland to work in the metro area on both economic issues as well as bringing the community and giving a different view of what was perceived to be the community back then. Sort of feels similar today. The mission of the organization is to work with all members of the community to advance and assist the advancement of the Latino community in Oregon and Southwest Washington, which is the area that we sort of operate from. We have currently right now 926 members, and we're one of the largest chambers in our state, and we are definitely the largest Hispanic chamber in the Pacific Northwest. We do our work through couple of areas. We're a nonprofit, which sends us into a different space, and people usually don't think of chambers as nonprofits. But we do these, and we impact economic advancement through three areas. Leadership development. We now are currently in our 11th class of leadership development. We take up-and-coming Latino professionals through a year-long program and develop their skills in arenas that they typically would not necessarily learn from within their systems. Latinos tend to, especially the professional ones, early on work in isolation. So this is meant to work on things like, who are you? You know, Nike does the brand Call You. The Port of Portland does strategic planning, and it looks both at a local, both a national and international mindset, giving some of those strategic planning. Some of the MBA programs work on some of the other issues, and we have great partners that help us do this. We've graduated 228 participants from that, and they've gone on to do really amazing things. We also do this through scholarships for college as well as graduate work. 1996, the organization took on education as a business issue. And from that standpoint, they've been putting out about $170,000 a year raised through the community out into about 40 to 45 students. We have about 13 education partners that match dollar for dollar. So last year, we gave about $178,000 to 42 students, putting us over the $2 million investment in scholarships in Oregon. Let's see. And my last program, which is what I actually spend most of my time, I've been with the organization now going on my 14th year, and it's running the technical assistance program that supports small business. That is the side of the house that works one-on-one with bicultural, bilingual business development coordinators providing one-on-one technical assistance to those future entrepreneurs. Or what we call legalizing businesses that have been operating informal in the gray economy. We've served about 3,500 small businesses since we started. 81% of the people who we serve are Latino. The remaining balance is the general community. 75% are women, so we have a higher concentration of women, and this is because Latinas create more businesses than both the average community and also higher than the Latino males. And also going into fields that are strange to both the general community as well as within the Latino community. we have a high concentration of Latina-owned construction companies. And you would never necessarily see that because you'll see the husband or brother or cousin or father out there on the field. We've been able to help these small businesses access over $11 million in small business financing, credit loans, IDAs. It's another tool to help get assets and help people through that challenge of starting up a business. And we've impacted 2,300 jobs, both retaining them and so as well as creating them. And that's all I have. I think that should help us catch up some time.
That's great. Do we have questions for this panel? Yes, Pam, and then I'm sorry, Rep. Marsh, and then Rep. Helm.
I have a question for Skip. So you definitely got our attention up here when you mentioned the $105,000 jobs, and you noted that high-tech industry is really looking at infrastructure and quality of life issues. So my question to you is, are there two or three areas in which we have particular deficits, or spoken another way, opportunities to address those particular needs?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the big areas that we're focused on right now is with diversity and inclusion. And so as you're looking at growing the local base of talent, mm-hmm. we can't just continue to import. And so as the industry continues to grow, they add more job openings, they're increasingly looking at how can they add more sort of infrastructure as it relates to junior hires. Because one of the big issues companies face is not only just how do you get someone in the door, but also how do you keep them there? Mm-hmm. How are they made happy? How are they sort of integrated with the overall culture of the company? Is the culture welcoming enough? And so it's both what do you do with talent once they're in the door, but also kind of how do you get them there in the first place? So we've gone after some grant funding through the Tech Hire Initiative federally in concert with the Workforce Investment Boards in the greater Portland area. So we got a total of $9 million across two Workforce Investment Boards over the course of the next few years, again, focused on youth between the ages of 18 and 29. And so it focuses on this sort of junior entry problem, both with setting up apprenticeship programs, again, solving the issue of what infrastructure exists for people once they're inside the companies, and then also sourcing by working really closely with community-based organizations that have great relationships and trust with people from a variety of different communities who otherwise wouldn't consider technology-related career. We're also doing some similar work with apprenticeship programs in Eugene, and then with the State Employment Department looking at a similar model in Central Oregon and then statewide. So the goal there is to try and increase the overall supply of talent from more diverse backgrounds. If the tech industry here does not get more diverse as the global customer base is, they have issues. So even if you're looking at it through that narrow lens of how are the companies understanding where the market is headed and developing products for that, they have a sense of urgency there. And so that's not unique to Oregon, but it's something that we're trying to solve it through our own unique approaches here.
Great. Rep. Helm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question is for Skip as well. You don't see numbers in front of the word trillion very often anymore in connection with any business. And can you comment for us a little bit on how Oregon is positioned to take advantage of the revolution in smart cities, especially vis-a-vis our more advanced land use planning and the connection with an already mature tech community in the state?
Sure. I mean, one way to look at it is that we have an amazing base that we're starting from and that we're known globally for urban planning, transportation planning, focus on development as it relates to managed growth. And you start to layer in a technology story there by looking at different pilot projects that can be done, whether it's in a rural agricultural setting or whether it's in an urban setting. These issues are shared by multiple cities, right? Small, medium, and large. There's transportation issues in small communities and large ones. There are issues around public safety and how do you get food to, this end destination in a quality way where price is not crazy. And all these things potentially have technology solutions in helping to make them more efficient and helping to provide more effective government services and empowering people with the information they need to make more informed decisions. And that's where you get massive scale behavior change, such that if you're looking at climate impacts, for example, you get people the right information where they can choose the right mode of transit. The CO2 impacts can go down dramatically. And then you also provide the infrastructure along the way to make those choices more accessible. And that's where cities are going. And this is not something just happening here in Oregon or just even in the U.S. We had cities from Europe and Asia coming to the Portland area last week because they're facing a lot of these issues, in some cases in a stronger way than more dire way than we are here. And so we're a small market, but because there's a long history of innovation in these areas, you start to add the technology pilots into this, and suddenly you've got access into a global marketplace that is truly estimated around $60 trillion with smart infrastructure.
Interesting. So, Jonathan, I have a question for you. Are there steps? It sounds like your organization is doing a lot of really important work, but I don't think I heard you say identify even in a steps that you'd like to have us consider on this committee to support increasing economic opportunity for members of your chamber.
Sure.
If you have some just gut response things you'd like to flag now, great, but also if you'd like to circle back and provide more input later, that'd be great. Do you have an initial?
Yes, and thank you for the opportunity. There's a lots of conversation around that topic. I would urge you to consider going back and looking at back at the investment that the state used to make under the targeted services providers out of Business Oregon at this time. It was a different agency. And it was looking at community-based organizations to get to the economic development, working with someone who was credit challenged to get them up to working with someone who had financial issues or did not know they had assets, and looking at those financial tools to begin an IDA so they can raise some funds for that future business. That was something that was very successful, and today, you know, 10, 12, 13 years later, I can give you businesses in Oregon that are $3, $4 million businesses with 20, 30 employees that came out of that initial, and you know, touch. And it took 10 years, right? But that's the type of investment that I think when we look at the future along the way, we're looking at. You guys did something early, late last year with refunding of the IDA funds. That's a very significant tool. It's more and more significant for the rural communities. We're just not getting enough of it out. There's not enough people in the rural communities really doing the ground on the ground work. You have to have a base in those communities in order to do that work, and we're not seeing that money dispersed in those communities as much as some of the metro areas.
Okay, so we've got more work to do, and really appreciate both of you being here and everyone who's able to be here today. So to summarize, we've just spent the last couple of meetings going through the levers that state government has and the kind of the ecosystem of groups in the state involved with economic development and trade, you know, from local to federal to private organizations, advocacy and trade organizations. And starting next week, we're going to begin looking at bills. We're going to be looking at a small business development center related bill and a bill related to interior design, interior designers and their ability to kind of professionalize and create opportunity within their framework. A lot of meaty conversations coming up on issues that we won't all agree on, but it's important conversation for us to have, and I look forward to it. Thank you. This closes the information session, and also we're adjourned for the day. Thanks
again. Thank you.
And also we're adjourned for the day. Thanks
again. Thank you.
Session.